So, it's pretty salty stuff, that passage. Come like a thief. And he says, you have a reputation for being alive, but you're dead. What does it have to do with you? What does it have to do with me? We're going to look at this church in of Sardis as we've gone through each church as a case study. And we as a church community, you as a Christian, or if you're not a Christian and you don't know what you believe, you may not be in the place that they're at right now, but every one of these letters to every one of these churches is a cautionary tale of what to be aware of. And we looked all throughout them. I won't recap every single one, but Jesus writes to the church in Ephesus and he says, you're doing really, really well, but you've lost that passion for me. You're just going through the motions. He writes to Smyrna, I know you love me and I know you're following me, but when persecution comes and when the trials come in your life, will you abandon me? And in each letter, for the most part, he starts off in this formula. This is the way Jesus usually writes these letters. He usually says something like this. This is what you're doing well. This is what you're doing really, really poorly. And this is what you need to do to get back on track. The letter to Sardis, though, is one of the few letters where almost nothing good is said. He says there's some of you who haven't soiled your clothes, but he doesn't start, as he does with other letters, most of the other letters, with a compliment. He doesn't start that way. He says, you have a reputation. Everyone looks at you, church, and they say you're alive, but I know you're dead. You have no pulse. And I want to look at this today to see what does it mean to have a life, to be living as a church, as a Christian in your heart. What does it mean to be alive? That's why I titled it Your Life. But first, let me backtrack a little bit. See, these letters are extremely important for you, believe it or not, and me. Because each of these letters, all seven of them, are written to Christians, a church, seated in a major, or rather major, metropolitan area, a city, an urban center. And so the church naturally would be filled with workers who would go to the marketplace and sell and buy and reap and sow and make. And the city of Sardis, as we'll see in a little bit, was known for one interesting, unique thing. The first city, we believe, the first culture to learn how to dye wool. So all you guys who are wearing colored clothes, you can thank Sardis this evening. And it comes to bear in a little while. But what I want to point out is this. These letters were all written to Christians, to the church, people who were working in a city. Sound familiar? It's you. It's me. It's all of us. These are all just Christians working out their faith in a major metropolitan area. And Jesus comes to them and says, this is how you're going to have to do it. This is how you have to work out grace and truth and mercy in your life. Now, Monday morning, go to work and figure it out. He says to them, you have a reputation for being alive, but you're dead. See, like you and like me, or like anybody who works in a city who's a believer, maybe you're not a believer just yet, but you want to be, you're going to have to work out what we call two different citizenships. See, you go to work tomorrow, and you're a citizen of a country, or you're a citizen of a place, or you belong to the school that you work at, or the office building that you work at. That's one citizenship that you have. But we know, if we believe, if we call ourselves Christians, we know that we have another citizenship, one that's in heaven. That's our ultimate citizenship. But the Bible says, while on earth, you're going to have to work out your faith within this citizenship. How do you struggle and straddle the lines between dual citizenship? Some of you may actually be dual citizens of another two countries. Which one are you? Are you this one or are you this one? Let me explain it this way. The way Augustine works this concept out, and he has this Christian classic, you should read it, City of God. I won't bore you, it's a long one. But what he does is this. He says, listen, around 410 AD, the city of Rome, the eternal city, was sacked by the Vandals. And everybody started to question how Rome, the eternal city, could possibly be sacked and crushed and taken over. And Augustine says, basically, you guys have been living as if you were citizens of Rome. And when Rome falls, you fall. But Augustine argues that if you believe that you're a citizen of the city of God, then when Rome falls, you don't fall with it. You don't rise and fall with your careers. You don't rise and fall with the culture around you. Augustine says you have to work out dual citizenship. On one hand, you are a citizen here on earth. You go to work tomorrow. On the other hand, you and I have got to work out the eternal implications of being a citizen of God. And that's what the city in Sardis had messed up with. Let me explain. See, Augustine goes on to argue, and he has a statement where he says, the value of the city that we live in, the values around you will at one point conflict. The values of this city that we live in, and I'm not knocking Seoul, so don't get me wrong, any city that you live in, the values of that city will inevitably at one point conflict with the values of the city of God. How do you spend your time? How do you spend your money? How do you network and make friends? How do you build your career? The culture around us will tell us one way to do it. Augustine argues that if you're a citizen of that city, you will be ruled by those values. But you and I, if we call ourselves believers, if we call ourselves Christians, we know we have a better citizenship in the city of God, and we've got to know what He wants out of us as citizens. And it's a challenge. It's going to challenge the culture. You'll see this in Sardis today. They've lost it. He says, you have a reputation. You have a name. You look like you're alive, church. You know what this means? It means that they were probably filling the pews. It means that their children's program was probably growing. It means that everybody would, if you moved into this city, people would go, you know that church? I want to go there. That's the one. They had a wonderful reputation, much like the city of Sardis did, which I'll explain. But somewhere along the line, it had decayed so much and they didn't even realize it. And God says, you're dead. You think you're alive, but you've got no heartbeat, no pulse. Wake up. And the gospel truth is going to be the only thing that wakes you and me up this morning. It's going to be the only thing that I call, say, roars you back to life. Hold on to that. I'll get to it in a little bit. See, the problem here with the church of Sardis, they had started to assimilate, which is natural. They started to look at the surrounding culture and started to look and act and do everything that their coworkers were doing, everything that their fellow students were doing. They had blended in, and they had lost their pulse. They were dead on the inside. Oh, they look great on the outside. Great website, great children's program, probably smashing sermons, much better than I can give. But they were dead. No heartbeat. So what does that mean for you and me? Well, I don't think we're at that point yet, and I hope you're not. I hope you don't feel dead inside. But it's a cautionary tale. We have to learn from them. So let's learn tonight, if you will. And I just have two headings, normally three. I'm just giving you two tonight. And it's really simple to remember: spiritual death, spiritual rescue. What does it mean to be spiritually dead? Why is this church dead? How are they dead? What does it mean for you and me to be dead spiritually, yet alive on the outside? We come, we sing our praise songs, we pray, we read our Bible. Jesus says, I know all that you're doing, but you're dead inside. No pulse. Get it back. Wake up. Here is what he does. First, nothing really positive, like I said, is said about this church in Sardis. They had a reputation. Everyone around them knew this church in Sardis. It was popular, so to speak. But they were living off of that reputation. And they had begun to decay so badly that they couldn't even see it. And commentators point out that this mirrors the exact history of the city of Sardis itself. See, at one time, Sardis was, it was a capital of what they called the Lydian kingdom around 560 BC. A long time ago, they were a capital. They were a center of commerce and industry. They were in the wool business, which comes into play a little bit later. And they said, you know, they made all this wool, they made garments and cloth and everything like that, and they were extremely powerful, extremely powerful. And they came to a point that even they were dead one time, they were sacked, they were destroyed, and yet they rebuilt themselves. This was a strong city. This was a city everybody knew. They were even more famous because they had this gigantic wall that nobody could conquer, and they were immensely proud about it. But commentators note that in a few hundred years, that city had begun to decay so badly that they were a pitiful remnant of their former selves. One commentator says, no city in Asia at the time presented a more melancholy contrast between past splendor and steady decline. See, they had a reputation, but they were living on that. And slowly the heartbeat, boom. got slower and slower. As a way to say this, you, me, as Christians, as a church, we can look incredibly great on the outside, yet be incredibly dead on the inside. And it comes very, very slowly. Look at this when Jesus says, he has a little wordplay, and I'll give you some history to it. He says, if you don't, wake up. I'll come like a thief in the night, and you won't know when I'll come. You know what he's referring to? He's actually referring to the time in 195 BC, and the Syrians went to the city of Sardis, and there was this great big wall. Nobody had conquered that wall. Nobody could, and the Sardis were so proud about it. Until one Syrian soldier found a back door, and they snuck in the middle of the night when everyone was sleeping, and they destroyed the city. What Jesus is in effect saying is, listen, the very things that you rest on, the very things you're most proud about, are the things that will make you fall asleep, the things that will distract you, the things that will make you weak and vulnerable. A church, a Christian, can live off past glory, can live off the way they first felt when they first met Jesus, and yet years and years and years go by, and we decay. And slowly our heartbeat stops. When Jesus says, listen, you have that big wall, I know, and you're so proud about it, and you're so insurmountable, but something's going to creep in the back door, and it'll eat you alive, and you won't ever even feel it. There's a part in C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters. If you don't know the premise of the book, here it is in a nutshell. Screwtape is a demon, the devil demon, and he has a patient who's a Christian. And he has his nephew, and Screwtape writes these letters to, I know Screwtape's a funny name, but he writes these letters to his nephew. And he says, this is the way you're going to destroy this Christian. But it's not the way you and I would think. He doesn't say go to him and give him all temptations and give him all evil sins and vices and that will distract him. No, here's what he says. When Screwtape writes to his nephew, he says, he, the Christian, the patient, must not be allowed to suspect that he is now, however slowly, heading right away from the sun on a line which will carry him into the cold and dark of utmost space. For this reason, I'm almost glad to hear that he's still a churchgoer and a communicant. I know there are dangers in this, but anything is better than that he should realize the break it has made with the first months of his Christian life. As long as he retains externally the habits of a Christian, he can still be made to think of himself as one who has adopted a few friends and amusements, but whose spiritual state is much the same as it was 6 weeks ago. And while he thinks that, we do not have to contend with the explicit repentance of a definite, fully recognized sin, but only with his vague, though uneasy, feeling that he hasn't been doing very well lately. And he closes by saying this, nephew, indeed, the safest road to hell is the gradual one, the gentle slope, soft underfoot, without sudden turnings, without milestones, without signpost, your affectionate uncle, Screwtape. You see what he says there? He says, don't wake him up. Let him stay in the lethargy of his behaviors. Let him go to church. Screwtape says to his nephew, I'm almost glad that he still goes to church, because he's blind to what's really eating him. And he's blind to the sin that's in his life. And he's blind to exactly how desperate he is and how lost he is. Good. Keep it that way. The safest way to hell is the soft road, the easy road, the gentle slope, no signposts, no warnings. This is what Sardis had become, at least the church. They'd begun to look and act and talk and think and do everything like everyone around them. They were not distinct anymore. But it had happened so slowly and insidiously over time that they didn't even know it. He says the church in Sardis had a reputation for being alive, but it was dead. Let me put it this way. Another illustration for you if you want. There's a big difference between existing and living. The church in Sardis existed, but it wasn't living. What do I mean by that? Well, let me take you, put you next to a plant. The plant exists. You live. The plant can't reason or show emotion or have love or compassion or forgiveness or feel anything. It's living in a sense. Technically, yes, but it's existing, not living. Living means having a pulse. Living means having fervor, passion, going, thriving. This is why Jesus says in some translations, they need to be, he says, arouse yourselves, which can be kind of scandalous. So some most translations call it, wake up now. You should know that that verb is an extremely strong word. He's yelling at them in a good way, because it is, after all, Jesus. He's saying, wake up. Don't just exist anymore. Stop it. Start living. It's like that line from Shawshank Redemption when Red says, get busy living or get busy dying. You would go one way or the other. And Screwtape writes to his nephew and says, let him think he's doing just fine. That's where I want him. Not living, just existing. Next, he says, they've soiled their clothes in verse 4. Not only were they had no pulse, the soft road underfoot, gradually the road to hell, decay, and they didn't even know it, snuck in through the back door while they were sleeping. But he says, also you soiled your clothes, and you should know that this would be extremely meaningful if you are Sardinian, I always get the names wrong. If you are a person from Sardis, I'll just say that from now on, I always mess up their names. If you were a person from Sardis and you read this, you would take great offense. Do you know why? Because, like I said, this was the town explicitly known for making fabrics and wool and clothing. And they were proud to call themselves the first city in the world to invent dyeing of clothes. And he says, you've soiled your clothes. The very thing that you are most proud of, that you hold up as your accomplishment, your achievement, your sense of value and worth, is the very thing that's the dirtiest in your life. And you can't even see it. It's a stain. Okay, when I got married to my wife, actually, probably one of the first times that my wife visited me when we were still dating and we were engaged, but definitely when we got married, I would wear some jeans. And I consider myself a somewhat fashionable fellow. But, you know, I'm frugal, so I like to keep, if pants last for a long time, I'll wear them for a long time. That's okay with me. I don't mind. So I've like had things for like 8, 9, 10 years. I know, it's like makes you aghast, right? And slowly over time, those things get little holes in them. Or they get little stains on them, especially my pants. I don't know why. Maybe because I'm cooking and I wipe like this. And it wasn't until I got married that my wife started looking at my clothes and saying, honey, look, you can't wear that outside. Look at that. Can I buy you some new pants? Can I buy you a new shirt? And I would say, well, what's wrong with this? It's fine. It's gotten me this far. Stains that I was wearing that I couldn't even see myself. She saw them. Everyone else probably saw them. And at least she was my friend enough to tell me and to go buy me a new pair of pants or a new shirt. See, this is what was going on in Sardis. This is what goes on in the church even today. We live with the stains of our lives so much and so long that we grow oblivious to it. And he says, you have soiled your clothes. And the Sardinians would have said, no, we're known for making clothes. That's all we got. That's our claim to fame. And he says, but they're so soiled and stains, and you've been walking in them so long you can't even see. You think you're alive, but you're dead. You think you're clean, but you're soiled. They have the stains. They have no pulse. And Jesus says, wake up. He says, arouse. You know what that means? It's almost as if somebody's coming and kicking you when you're in bed. Get up. Now, how do you do it? They were spiritually dead. They were spiritually soiled. And I'm not saying that we're at that point right now. Hopefully, we won't get that way as a church. But how do you get it back? How do you get rescued? You don't get it back, and I don't get it back by our own efforts. I'll say that first and foremost. We have to be roared back into life. Let me explain. First of all, most commentators point out that Jesus comes to this church, Sardis, and he's pretty heavy-handed. Do you not see this? He doesn't really mince words with them. And he doesn't have a lot of nice things to say about them. He's pretty PO'd. And he's tired of it. But you have to see that he's not just simply and merely scolding them. He's loving them. He says in verse 3, he wants them back. He says, just remember. Remember what it was like when you first fell in love with me. Remember what it was like when you had a pulse, a heartbeat. When you woke up and you thought about me. When you went to sleep and you thought about me. You didn't just go to church and go through the motions. You lived it, you breathed it, you pulsed it, and everyone around you knew it. He says, remember this. He is not simply scolding them. But he has to wake them up. And he says, arouse. Wake up. He roars. I keep saying the word roars, and this is why. Because if you remember the story, another C.S. Lewis story, it's a big C.S. Lewis night, I guess, a C.S. Lewis fest here. The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. But there comes that part, and I'm going to read it for you. We have a little story time. Is that okay? You can close your eyes now for some of you if you want. We'll have a little story time. The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. You remember the story. The lion, Aslan, dies, gets killed on the stone tablet. And most people don't really remember the part that happened right after that. I'm going to read it for you. Because it's an illustration, it's a mirror to what when Jesus says, wake up, get up, get life. He's roaring. Here's what I mean. Aslan the lion has just woken up. He's come back alive. And of course, the girls are there with him, Lucy and her sister. And he says, oh, children, this is the story time. You can close your eyes if you want. Oh, children, said the lion. I feel my strength coming back to me. Oh, children, catch me if you can. He stood for a second, his eyes very bright, his limbs quivering, lashing himself with his tail. Then he made a leap high over their heads, and he landed on the other side of the table, laughing, though she didn't know why. Lucy scrambled over it to reach him. Aslan leaped again. A mad chase began. Round and round the hilltop he led them, now hopelessly out of their reach, now letting them almost catch his tail, now diving between them, now tossing them in the air with his huge and beautifully velveted paws and catching them again and now stopping unexpectedly so that all three of them rolled over together in a happy, laughing heap of fur and arms and legs. It was such a romp as no one has ever heard except in Narnia. And whether it was more like playing with a thunderstorm or playing with a kitten, Lucy could never make up her mind. And the funny thing was that when all three finally lay together, panting in the sun, the girls no longer felt in the least tired or hungry or thirsty. He tossed them in the air. But the real cool part comes next. And now, Aslan said presently, to business. I feel I am about to roar. You had better put your fingers to your ears. And they did. And Aslan stood up, and when he opened his mouth to roar, his face became so terrible that they did not even dare look at it, and they saw all the trees in front of him bend before the blast of his roaring, as grass bends in the meadow before the wind. He roars. And spring comes again. Winter had dominated their lives. Nature itself was dead until Aslan roared. He says, now to business. I feel I am going to roar. And that, brothers and sisters, is the roar that you and I need if we want to wake up. You want to be aroused? You want to be woken up? Hear the roar. Let him roar you back. Aslan says, when I roar, spring comes again. This is why Jesus in John chapter 10 says, verse 10, he says, I came to give life. What? Not just life. Life abundantly. I want you to have a joy you never felt. I want you to have a romp such as never been seen except in Narnia. I want you to have a laughing, heaping. I want you to feel my paws, he would say. Aslan tosses him in the air, and he jumps, and they chase, and they run, and they sit down, and they said Lucy could not even remember if she was hungry or thirsty or tired anymore, and then he roared. Life comes again. How do you apply this? You got to apply it your own way. What does it mean that Jesus roars you back into life, not just existence? I'll explain what it means for me. You can apply it to you. As many of you know, and if you were here the last few weeks, you've known that I've been quite open with some of my struggles recently. Three or four weeks ago, I got up on the stage and I couldn't even give a sermon. I have been and still continue to struggle with depression, and I've probably done it since I was a little kid in my early life. And it's been pretty bad at times and debilitating. And if you know, and if you don't, if you know somebody who has issues with depression and struggle with it, or if you yourself have, you know there's something unique about depression. What it does is this: it makes you be in the room with the people, but not really all there. You don't feel, you're existing, but you're not living. But that's what depression has done with me now. How do I apply this? Because I have to go back to the cross, to the gospel, and hear him roaring for me. I have to say, I'm tired of just existing as a father. I'm tired of just existing as a husband. I'm tired of just existing as a pastor or whatever it is. I want to live. I want life. I want a pulse. I can't do it on my own. I have to hear the roar. I have to hear him cry out for me. And I've heard that roar. And I'll be quite honest with you, it's the only thing that keeps me, it's the only thing that arouses me, the only thing that wakes me up. Otherwise, I'll exist, but I'll never live. Jesus comes to the church in Sardis, and he comes to you, and he comes to me. Work it out your own way. I don't know. How are you going to hear him roar? How's he going to wake you up? He will. And here's what he'll give you. He says, if you conquer, if this happens to you, you get what? White robes. Do you know what that means? White robes, at the time, were only worn by Roman emperors when they were victorious in battle, and they'd come back into the city, and they'd wear a white robe. And he looks at this church, and he says, I know you. You've lost your pulse. You are dead, decaying, dying. You've soiled your clothes. And then he says, of all things, you get victory. You get to wear the robe. Why? Because when before Jesus went to the cross, he lost his robe. Jesus says, look, you have a stained robe. And if you're honest with yourself, you've been walking around with the stains so long, you can't even see them. I'll take it. Give me that robe. You get mine. This is the king who soiled his clothes, went to the cross naked to give you victory in your life. Let him roar at you today. Let me press that further. What I mean by roar is this. You say, when did Jesus roar? When did ever Jesus did? When did he roar, Pastor? Go back to the book of Matthew 27, verse 50. And there's a part that most people skip over. It's Jesus on the cross, and he's dying. He's been suffering on the cross and hanging there, and probably commentators say sobbing and whimpering, as you would probably do when you're hung on a cross. You can hardly even lift your body up. You can't make a noise, but you're suffering. You're bleeding. You're suffocating. And he's whimpering probably, and he's sobbing, but then it says, Matthew 27:50, he cried out again in a loud voice. And I know we like to read that in like church. We read it, you know, if you have somebody who's a good Bible reader and they read, and he cried out in a loud voice. No! He roared, is what it says. He cried out. Why? For you. You want to hear him roar for you. You want to come to life again. You want to wake up. You want to go out these doors and have a pulse again. The only thing that will do it is if you hear him on the cross cry out again in a loud voice, not a whimper, not a sob. He cries. He roars, and you get life. You get to live forever. Stains wiped clean. Life instead of just existence. And now, said Aslan presently, to business. I feel I am going to roar. You had better put your fingers in your ears. Mr. Beaver puts it better earlier, and he says, wrong will be right when Aslan comes in sight. At the sound of his roar, sorrows will be no more. When he bares his teeth, winter meets its death. And when he shakes his mane, we shall have spring again. Wrong will be right when Aslan comes in sight. At the sound of his roar, sorrows will be no more. When he bares his teeth, winter meets its death. And when he shakes his mane, we shall have spring again. Listen, in your life right now, if you're going through a winter period, or if you haven't, and you've gone through those periods, and you feel like that part of Narnia, when everything's dead, and you feel like you don't have a pulse anymore, and it's hard just to get up and get out of bed and go to work and go through the day, you need him to roar back at you. Let him cry into you. Let spring come again. He's on the cross. You can't wake yourself up, but if you hear him cry out your name, it'll wake you up. You can't help but become alive when he roars. And he roars in love for you, for me. Stained, lifeless people, let him roar over you. Don't just exist. Start living. That's what he wants from the church in Sardis. That's what he wants from us. You can't do it on your own. You can roar all you want. You can put on all the nice robes you want. That's what they were doing in the city. He says, the only life you get is when you hear my roar. Wake up now. Pulsate now. Spring will come again. Go in prayer now and ask God, what does this mean? Apply it to your life. Take a moment, reflect on it. Maybe you've never heard him roar for you. Maybe you've never been woken up. This is your chance tonight to let that happen. Let him come into your life. And if you've been a Christian for a long time and this is something that's old hat to you, let him roar it again from the cross, dying for you. And you get the white robe. Go in prayer.